Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. It's early morning when Brandon and I are recording this month's podcast, but maybe it's also early morning for you if you happen to be listening to us during your early morning commute. If so, thank you for starting your day with us. And hopefully you'll enjoy this month's podcast. Right, Brandon?
Yep. This month, we have some pretty interesting topics as we review CME articles on rheumatoid arthritis and management of high-risk breast lesions. Additionally, we'll discuss an article on paraesophageal hernias and the working relationship between PAs, NPs, and residents.
Yeah, thank you, Brandon, for that introduction. And as always, our quick disclaimer. This podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they do not represent JAPA, the authors, or the editor's opinions, or the publisher. This is not intended as medical advice.
And remember, when you read both CME articles, review the post-test, and then take the test online, if you get at least 70%, you get one category CME. Now, let's get on to the CME.
On to our first CME article, Diagnosing and Managing Patients with Rheumatoid Arthritis by Michelle DeBassier and Samantha Kahn. Michelle is a professor and chair of the PA program at A.T. Still University in Mesa, Arizona, and Samantha is an internal medicine resident at the University of Arizona in Phoenix. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. Rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease, usually caused by genetic or environmental factors. However, there seems to be some strong associations between one's genetics and the development of rheumatoid arthritis, more specifically the HLA-DR beta-1 allele. This allele codes for the epitope known as the shared epitope, which causes a process known as citrullination to occur. Citrullination causes the amino acid arginine, which is found within proteins, to be converted into citrulline. Some of the proteins affected by this are fibrinogen, fibrin, and vimentin. Once these proteins have been converted into citrulline, they are referred to as anti-cyclic citrullinated proteins, also known as anti-CCP, which is important to note when we discuss the diagnostic tests for RA. After these proteins have been converted into anti-CCP, they're vulnerable for attack by the immune system. A major environmental risk factor for RA is tobacco smoke, as this increases citrullination of proteins. Additional genes that have been strongly linked to the development of RA is PTPN22, which stands for protein tyrosine phosphatase N22. This leads to citrullination of proteins and also increases T and B cell activity, leading to activation of pro-inflammatory mediators. This specific gene also contributes to other autoimmune diseases such as type 1 diabetes, lupus, and Hashimoto's. For the clinical manifestations of RA, it's most common onset in the ages between 35 and 50 and has an increased prevalence in women more than men at a 3-to-1 ratio. Your patient may also complain of prolonged morning stiffness, joint pain, and small joints are usually affected first with progression into the larger joints. On exam, you may notice symmetric swelling of the wrist, MCP, PIP, and MTP joints, which may be accompanied by ulnar deviation. On palpation, you may notice an edematous and boggy joint line, decreased range of motion, a boutonniere deformity, which this is a hyperflexion of the PIP, and a swan neck deformity, which is a hyperextension of the PIP with flexion of the DIP. Also, you may have extra articular findings on exam, such as rheumatoid nodules, pulmonary fibrosis, and secondary Sjögren's syndrome. Real quick review of Sjögren's, your patient may have dry eyes, dry mouth, dry skin. For your differential diagnosis, just real quickly, broken up by system, for muscle skeletal, you may want to also think of osteoarthritis, gout, pseudogout. For infectious disease, you might think of septic joint, hep C, parovirus, Lyme's disease, or Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And for rheumatological diseases that may cross your mind are psoriatic arthritis, lupus, polymyalgia rheumatica, and fibromyalgia. The article does a really great description of helping to differentiate these diseases from one another as well. Okay, to confirm the diagnosis of RA, the American College of Rheumatology, ACR, and the European League Against Rheumatism, EULAR have created diagnostic criteria. There's a really nice table in the article to help lay this out, but basically criteria is based on the number of affected joints, inflammatory markers such as CRP, ESR, anti-CCP, and rheumatoid factor, as well as duration of the patient's symptoms and the acute phase reactants. For lab work, you want to grab a CRP, ESR level, anti-CCP, which is more specific for RA than rheumatoid factor, but you still want to grab a rheumatoid factor as well, and a CBC to assess for anemia of chronic disease, which is another common side effect from rheumatoid arthritis. For imaging, you want to grab an x-ray of the hands and feet. Also, high-frequency ultrasound or MRI could also be helpful to assess for synovial inflammation as well as erosive joint damage. While you're working up your patient, maybe you want to grab baseline LFTs, baseline renal function, a pregnancy test if your patient's a woman of childbearing age, and have your patient undergo a baseline retinal exam. This way you kind of have these things prior to you initiating drug therapy for your patient. Which, moving on to management of RA, DMARDs are first line. The ACR and EULAR recommend methotrexate, if it's not contraindicated, as the first selection. Which, by the way, I feel like we've already mentioned methotrexate so many times already on this podcast, even though this is only our fourth podcast. But real quick review, methotrexate is a folic acid antagonist, and it's recommended that methotrexate be started as soon as the RA has been diagnosed in your patient. Now, before starting your patient on a DMARD to assess for high-risk diseases such as heart failure, hepatitis B and C, malignancy, even if it's in their past medical history or a history of serious infection, glucocorticoid use should only be used short-term, less than 3 months, or used for acute flares or to prevent any acute flares when switching or starting DMARDs. It should also be noted that there are different classes of DMARDs based on their mechanism of action, which again, the article has a really nice chart that lays out the different classes. There's also another chart that lists out the different individual DMARDs and what baseline labs you should acquire before initiating therapy. Additional management includes physical therapy and occupational therapy for your patient to improve or maintain their mobility, strength, and endurance. But this can also be useful when figuring out any adaptive equipment your patient may need or figuring out any exercise programs and just educating your patient on joint protection. Additionally, a nutrition consult can be considered for weight loss as this puts more strain on the patient's joints. An application of heat or ice for pain relief. And if joint deformity is severe enough, then surgical intervention may be warranted. Two last major things to note are your patient's cardiovascular risk. Patients with RA have an increased risk of coronary artery disease and should be started on a statin and counseled on other factors to lower their risk. And also, you want to note your patient's vaccination status. This should occur prior to DMARD initiation, though, because once started on DMARDs, your patient can't receive any live vaccines. So this means you need to get in your patient's pneumococcal vaccine, HPV, flu, Hep B, herpes zoster, COVID, even though COVID's not a live vaccine, but still, vaccinate your patient. So Brandon, real quick, if you were a primary care provider, would you feel comfortable starting your patient on a DMARD to manage their RA, or would you just refer them to rheumatology?
I think initially I would be okay with starting them on methotrexate, but I would still want them to follow up with rheumatology for any additional treatment that may be needed. I felt like I learned a decent amount about methotrexate that I would be okay with starting it, but for the I guess like the chronic use of it, I would definitely want to get a rheumatology on board.
Yeah, I personally would be hesitant. I will never forget this one case. We had a patient, they weren't doing too well. We had to transfer them to step down, but basically they died from methotrexate toxicity and they were being just managed by their primary care provider with no guidance from rheumatology. So that just like scares me personally. So if I ever have a patient with RA, you're going to get a rheumatology consult for sure.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. The article that I will be reviewing today is Managing Patients with High-Risk Breast Lesions, Precursors on the Breast Neoplasia Pathway. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So this article is important because breast cancer remains the most commonly diagnosed cancer among women. Many women have atypia and carcinoma in situ, which can be identified via breast biopsy. It is important to become familiar with these lesions because they are also known to put women at an increased risk for invasive carcinoma. However, due to several factors, patients may not be able to access optimal management for the various subtypes of these non-malignant lesions. And as we go through this article, we should become a little bit more knowledgeable in how to better counsel, manage, and treat patients with these presentations. With the varying guidelines pertaining to preventative screening, patients may be getting mammograms every 1 or 2 years for the most part. However, what should remain as the mainstay is providing these patients with evidence-based and efficient care no matter if they present to a clinician in a PCP, gynecology, or surgical setting. The different types of lesions we will focus on is atypical ductal hyperplasia, also known as ADH, atypical lobular hyperplasia, and lobular carcinoma in situ. These three variants of breast lesions have all been identified to increase the risk of breast cancer, and when found on biopsy, clinicians should consider whether the biopsy missed the actual cancer, and is the patient at an increased risk for developing cancer with this history of atypia or LCIS. And the hallmark presentation for these variants are disordered overgrowth and the differences in the location of origin, with either it being part of the ducts or the lobules. And to give a little patho refresher, if we think of the nipple as the starting point of the breast and you move a little distal to that in any direction, you have your ducts, and then slightly distal to that, you have your lobules. Distal to that region is where you'll have your lymph nodes. So ADH is similar to ductal carcinoma in situ, also known as stage zero breast cancer. However, the differentiating characteristics is that ADH is less than 2 millimeters or present in less than 2 glands. And when this is diagnosed with a needle biopsy, it is encouraged for patients to undergo an excisional biopsy due to the increased risk of about 15 to 30% in regards to the development of invasive cancer. All of these patients should also receive breast cancer risk counseling and also consider the use of risk-reducing medications, which we will touch on in a little bit. Secondly, ALH is similar to ADH, however, the location is different as stated before. It is characterized by disordered proliferation in the terminal ductal lobular units with overgrowth that involves less than about 50% of the acini of a terminal ductal lobular unit. The management of ALH is surgical excision, and after being diagnosed with a needle biopsy, there is also data supporting that follow-up imaging at 6 and 12 months to monitor patients with no additional risk factors can suffice as well. The lifetime risk of the development of invasive cancer is fourfold for these patients, so they should again receive breast cancer risk counseling and also consider the use of risk-reducing medications. LCIS, lobular carcinoma in situ, is similar to ALH. However, it involves 50% or more of the acini of a terminal ductal lobular unit, and the primary management is excisional biopsy, as the future risk for cancer is between 8 and 10-fold for this lesion. And pleomorphic lobular carcinoma in situ, which is relatively rare, is a high-grade lesion that has a higher degree of variation in shape and size. The primary treatment for this lesion is surgical excision with clean margins, and the future risk of invasive cancer is still unknown due to insufficient data. And lastly, we'll touch on flat epithelial atypia, also known as FEA, and it's another rare lesion often found with other lesions. However, when found alone on needle biopsy, the recommendations is to follow up with the serial imaging at 6 and 12 months due to its low risk for the development of invasive cancer. The patients also do not need any medical therapy when this lesion is found in isolation. In order to guide further management, there are multiple risk assessment calculators that provide us with the 5- and 10-year risk, taking into account factors such as age and menopausal status, to name a few. There are also several risk factors that put patients at risk, such as family history, hereditary cancer syndrome, or history of chest radiation. For young patients with high risk factors, the recommendation is to consider MRIs, and this can start 5 to 10 years prior to the earliest diagnosis of family history, but not before the patient is 25. For patients between the ages of 25 and 29, it is recommended that they undergo yearly breast MRIs, and for women above the age of 30, they should undergo a mammogram along with the breast MRI. The primary issue with breast MRIs is that they have a higher false positive rate. However, they also have a higher sensitivity rate compared to mammograms. So this is one of those situations where you have to think of the risk to benefit ratio. the medications that can be used in order to help to prevent the development of invasive breast cancer is tamoxifen, raloxifen, exestamine, and anastrazole. And again, these medications are recommended for anyone with a history of ADH, ALH, or LCIS. And the data is promising for the efficacy of these medications. For example, there is one study that showed that the use of 20 milligrams of tamoxifen taken for approximately 4 years is associated with a 50% drop in breast cancers for pre- and postmenopausal women. The one thing to note about tamoxifen is that it is the one drug that is improved for treatment in premenopausal women and is relatively more efficient than raloxifen. With the use of SERMs, also known as selective estrogen receptor modulators, the main risk factor is the event of thromboembolic events, so be sure to educate patients on the signs and symptoms associated with DVTs and PEs when prescribing these medications. The other class of medications are aromatase inhibitors. Exestamine reduces the risk of invasive cancer by 65%, and anastrazole reduces the risk of invasive and in situ breast cancers by more than 50% compared to placebo. The one crossroad that we may come across as clinicians are patients who are young and healthy, who may fit the criteria to go on risk-reducing medications, but are hesitant due to the potential side effects or for personal reasons. So the best we can do is to keep the patient informed of the risk and inquire about any changes in family history that may increase their risk of developing breast cancer. And I know this is tough because I personally am someone who uses medicine as a last case scenario. Definitely understand patients who may have that same perspective when it comes to these types of situations. However, I think as a clinician, it's important just to provide them with the data that supports that, hey, this medication is something that will definitely decrease the occurrence of you developing this cancer. So Lynn, do you have any thoughts on that situation?
Not really. I mean, you said everything that I would have said as well. You have to kind of really understand your patient's perspective as to why, you know, they choose the treatment plan that they want to choose, even though it may not make sense to us or we may not agree with it.
And if you were in that situation being young and healthy and everything like that, would you go on these medications as a preventative measure?
That's really hard. I don't know. I guess I also have an advantage being a provider where I can also look at the pros and cons and my overall full picture, whereas patients, they may mm-hmm. not have that. So, and I still have that and I still don't know what I would do. but I don't know. I think overall, my family risk is low and everything like that, so I might choose not to or wait later and see how things go. But yeah,
I think main thing is to never put pressure on patients. Our job isn't to force anyone to do anything. It's just to inform them and make sure that they have the facts so that they will be able to make an informed decision on their own, and to be able to be there to answer any questions they may have. And so to sum things up, breast cancer screening is imperative when we speak of preventative medicine. Along with the preventative medications that can be used, we must always circle back to lifestyle modifications that patients can implement in their lives to help reduce their risk of developing breast cancer, such as exercise, maintaining a healthy weight, and limiting alcohol consumption, just to name a few. However, as clinicians, it is vital that we are able to recognize and educate our patients on the risk factors and solutions when we come across the numerous types of lesions associated with breast cancer.
All right. Thank you, Brandon, for that. Moving on to a case report, we're going to be reviewing a rare cause of a cavitary lung lesion in an infant by Sarah Tesserio and Alyssa Gross. Sarah and Alyssa practice pediatric hospital medicine at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore in Bronx, New York, while Dr. Gross is an assistant professor in the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in Bronx, New York. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So, basically, this had a really nice case scenario, which I'll kind of break up into kind of like a soap note. But so a mother brings in her 10-month-old girl into the ED for a fever of 100.8 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 day, which her mother has been managing with ibuprofen. accompanied by a cough times 1 month as the patient was recently hospitalized for suspected necrotizing pneumonia after presenting with fever, cough, and congestion for 5 days. During her original hospitalization, her labs were significant for an elevated white blood cell count, CRP level, and a negative PPD test as TB was suspected. Chest x-ray was significant for a cavitary lesion in the right lung base with a noted air fluid level, which was noted to also possibly be a hiatal hernia or a congenital pulmonary airway malformation. Ultimately, the patient was treated with IV ceftriaxone for necrotizing pneumonia, followed by a 2-week course of amoxicillin. While in the ED, the mothers endorsed that the patient did complete a full course of her antibiotics, but her cough never resolved and the fever returned. On follow-up outpatient chest ultrasound, findings were consistent with a cavitary pneumonia versus congenital lung lesion with no diaphragmatic hernia noted. For the patient's past medical history, she was significant for a preterm birth at 29 weeks gestation via induced vaginal delivery secondary to maternal preeclampsia. This was also followed by a 2-month stay in the NICU for feeding optimization and weight gain. While she was in the NICU, she was also diagnosed with a bilateral grade 3 intraventricular hemorrhage leading to a hydrocephalus, but no surgical intervention was warranted. She also had iron deficiency anemia, which she was treated for in the NICU with liquid iron supplementation. However, her mother states she stopped giving the patient her iron secondary constipation, which resolved with cessation of the iron supplement. On physical exam, the patient's vital signs were stable, as she was afebrile with a temperature of 98.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Her respiratory rate was 32 breaths per minute. SpO2 was 100% on room air. On exam, she was active, not in any acute distress. Her mucous membranes were moist, maybe had some mild nasal congestion, but oropharynx was not concerning for any erythema or exudates. Her cardiac exam was normal, as well as lung exam. An abdomen was soft with bowel sounds, non-tender, non-distended, without any masses or organomegaly. While in the ED, her labs were within normal limits as well, with a white blood cell count of 8.6 and a CRP level of 3. These were also compared to her labs that she had 1 month ago while she was hospitalized, and her white blood cell count at the time was 17, so there was a drastic improvement, and her CRP level was 11. While she was in the ED, infectious disease and pulmonology were consulted, and they recommended additional imaging. So, Brandon, before I go further, at this point, what do you think this patient may have?
I was reading through this, and I'm completely confused. I would have to look a little bit more deeper into it, because it's with her like presenting now completely okay. For the most part, it's a bit confusing. I would, if I had to like, I guess have a final answer, I would say that it's something that is associated with like not developing correctly at birth. So some type of malformation, like, either with the, like the lung or the stomach.
Okay. Alrighty. Yeah. When I was reading this, I was like, what in the heck is happening? At first, when it was just like, I just read the very first topic, I was like, fever and cough. I was like, maybe she has some bronchiolitis.
COVID.
But then, oh my God, no. No. And then it was like cavitary lung lesion. I was like, TB. And then it was like, no, not TB. And I was like, I have no idea. But, okay. So, infectious disease and pulmonology were consulted, recommended additional imaging. And at this point, their differential diagnosis was either congenital pulmonary malformation, which you said, or rare diaphragmatic hernia, which you kind of hinted at. So an upper GI series was obtained, which revealed a large congenital paraesophageal hernia in the right hemothorax. So at this point, the patient has a paraesophageal hernia, and she was still well appearing, afebrile, without any respiratory distress or hypoxia, and she was tolerating oral feedings and was discharged home. However, she was also provided a referral for pediatric surgery for a Nissen fundoplication with gastropexy and gastrostomy tube placement. Prior to discharge, the patient was tolerating full feedings after her surgery, and she had a removal of her gastrostomy tube 2 weeks post-op. So just a quick overview of paraesophageal hernia. In this case, the patient's hernia was congenital, but this is actually a rare presentation, and it's usually acquired. It's unclear for the cause for congenital paraesophageal hernia, but there are four different types. However, only types 2 through 4 are considered true paraesophageal hernias. The symptoms are usually kind of insidious. Patients may be asymptomatic, or they could be vomiting, presenting with GERD, frequent respiratory infections, failure to thrive, or anemia. But since these are so nonspecific, it's very easily missed. Some imaging you want to consider are chest x-ray, and as we saw in this case, chest x-ray may commonly reveal a cystic mass, air fluid levels within the cystic mass, or dilated esophagus. Other imaging that could be obtained are also an upper GI series or CT of the chest or abdomen. The mainstay treatment for this is always surgical, even if your patient's asymptomatic, due to the risk of gastric volvulus, necrosis, obstruction, and perforation. Surgical repair, though, focuses on reducing the hernia, excising the hernia sac, and closing the hiatal defect. And sometimes, if needed, an anti-reflux or fixation procedure, such as fundoplication, may be needed for your patient. Brandon, you did a really great job. You were correct in your differential diagnoses. I would still not know what to do. I would just be so lost, so overwhelmed.
Yeah, when you have provided the information of the, I guess, the past medical history of the child, I always just think of there, something happened during the development. That's always on my differential. But peds is so hard. It's shout out to all the pediatric PAs and clinicians out there, because there's just, you have to approach it in a completely different manner than you would an adult. So I'm pretty sure those people who come across peds patients on a day-to-day basis, it's probably like a no-brainer for them. But yeah, it threw me off for for a little bit.
Same.
Yep. So the last article that we will be reviewing is titled Exploring Residents' Perception of PAs and NP Roles and Barriers to Collaboration. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So the objective of this study was to help develop competencies for interprofessional collaboration and better clarity of roles of physician assistants and nurse practitioners in the healthcare settings. And the setup of the study took residents from an academic institution who encountered both PAs and NPs in the hospital and outpatient setting. The study asked a couple residents just their perception of, again, how they see PAs and how they seek to interact with them on a day-to-day basis, or what they would define their role as. And essentially, the responses stated that PAs were similar to a resident and less commonly perceived as an independent clinician or even a collaborator. These perspectives were based solely on their interactions with a PA or NP during their residency, and there was a clear consensus that there was little to no education provided to them in regards to the roles of other medical professionals that they may be working in collaboration with after their time in medical school. And I think this is a good topic, because it varies on where you see a PA. In the primary care setting, definitely works as an independent clinician. But also I've seen in the hospital where it really does seem like a PA is a resident, or even, low-level resident, where they're doing a lot of, I guess, administrative work or quote-unquote busy work with like pre- and post-op things. So I think this is something that there needs to be a constant conversation of. And I also think that PAs must also have a definite statement when introducing themselves to residents and patients alike, because we work in the hospital. It's guaranteed that at least, let's say, one out of every 10 patients, when you say you're a PA, they're going to be like, oh, what is that? And I found myself, I usually have a standard statement to describe the role of a PA. But sometimes I find myself not even sure when explaining, when my first line of, I guess, when my first response doesn't really resonate well with, not resonate, doesn't isn't clear to them or they don't understand it in that way, I'm not sure of how to describe it in another way. Because I usually get cut off and then, but, oh, so you're like a resident. Are you going to go back to school? And at that point, I just discuss, hey, no, like that wasn't the path, the career path that I chose. And I speak about like the lateral mobility of PAs. And when I add that aspect to it, they understand a little bit more. But it is tough because PAs vary from setting to setting, from state to state. And when we have a more concrete definition of what we do in each setting, I think both for patients and residents, it'll be a clear consensus and a clear understanding of what's going on. But it's tough adding that concept into a med school curriculum of, oh, let's go through all the different professions and how we're supposed to interact with them. Like you have perfusionists, the NPs, PAs. There's so many other professions out there besides being a physician in the medical field. And I feel like these residents are only, you just go off what you see. And majority of time you're seeing other doctors and you're seeing nurses. And it's hard to define actually what's going on in the middle. And I think over time and when things become more solidified, and I think as PAs become their own advocate and being proactive in describing these things or describing their roles to residents, things will be a little bit clearer. But I also don't think at the same time it's not our responsibility. I do think it is the institution's responsibility or should be part of their residency. Like, hey, you'll be working alongside some PAs and NPs. This is what they're supposed to do. This is your relationship with them. And this is how you'll move forward. So when there's some concrete guidelines on how to interact with one another, I think things will be a little bit smoother and roles will be more clearly defined between the two professions.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I wonder too, I know there's a lot of like things surrounding the PA title name change, which there are a couple of articles in this month's issue that kind of talk about that, but if that would kind of change things. But I also, that would also scares me is like these residents will one day be attendings and like be supervising physicians, you know, be our supervising physicians. And it's like, it's kind of scary because it's like, okay, what do you think of me as your PA? At some point we're not like, you know, as residents and PAs, they might view us as, oh, we're working aside each other. But once like, you know, you're my supervising physician, what is your perception of a PA? Now that, you know, again, we're working even more closely, which can be scary. Mm-hmm. I work in an academic hospital and work with residents, and an issue I think a lot of that I've seen is sometimes too a respect issue as well. And it's like, no, like, you know, I have, you know, the ability to like interpret labs and imaging and come up with diagnoses. And like, you know, we're also burdened with like, you know, especially being in a pandemic, the things going on as well, and you know, patients are deteriorating and things like that, and I don't think they fully understand that sometimes, which is frustrating. And that's sad too, because that ultimately, you know, we're an interdisciplinary team and that ultimately, you know, affects our patient care as well. But hopefully, like you said, we continue to kind of advocate for ourselves. And I think it would also be great, especially like, you know, July's coming up, new set of residents are coming in, just like a part of their basic training. Here are the people, like you said, you're working alongside. These are their responsibilities. This is what they do. And we just respect one another, acknowledge one another.
And also be, any type of relationship, personal, professional, just detail the responsibilities, detail exactly what's going on between both parties. At the beginning, make it clear and let it be known. And I think it's also imperative to also let PAs know what their relationship is supposed to be, because I think we go into these situations like, should I do this? Should I say this? Should I just ask the attending? So I think if we actually, I can only speak for me personally, I think if I had more concrete direction on how to interact with residents and attendings, these issues wouldn't be as prominent.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I like I want to make it clear, like, we respect residents, everything like that. Especially I work nights, so there's only one attending. And so, you know, if I need to transfer a patient to a higher level care, like, either I'm reaching out to the attending or the resident running that service. And, you know, they're usually really helpful. Or even, like, if I need a emergency consult, I'm usually, you know, interacting with the resident or the fellow. And so I appreciate their insight. And I acknowledge that, you know, especially if I'm reaching out to you, I'm acknowledging that you know more than I do about this particular instance. I'm assuming that. So, you know, by all means, this isn't to, like, disrespect or to, you know, shade residents either. And we understand too, it's a hard period. They get not much sleep, very little pay, so you know, but we just could improve on our relationship for sure. I just want to real quick have an honorable mention for one of the articles in this month's edition of JAPA. It's called Gut Check by Michael Littner. He's a pediatric PA, even though we were just talking about that. But I think also it kind of mentioned too, he is about asking for help, and he asked a pediatric NICU fellow to help him. And I think that was a really great way to summarize, or a great goal for how our relationship between residents and PAs can be. So definitely check that out. It's a really great read. I wanted to summarize it, but I felt like I couldn't evoke the same emotion the article itself did. So I just wanted to give that an honorable mention. But everyone, I hope you enjoyed this episode with Brandon and myself, as always. And we look forward to the articles for June, and we look forward to next month's podcast.
And please be sure that you're following JAPA on social media. Their social Instagram handle is @JAPAOnline. Let us know your thoughts about the topics we went over today. We love to hear your input.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.